Part 19, Chapter 3. Johnny was pitching rocks down off the bluff and into the lake. The vast lake, really an inland sea, stretched out to a cloudy horizon. There was a storm building up out there now, a not uncommon thing for this huge expanse of water. The bluff on which he stood rose nearly sheer, 200 feet above the lake. Erosion or some volcanic cataclysm from the cloud-hidden peaks to the northeast had covered the bluff top with rocks the size of a man's fist. They were simply made for throwing. He had formed the habit of daily trotting down here from the mine site a few miles away. It was hot and humid here at the equator, but the running did him good. He was not afraid of the various animals around here, ferocious though they might be, for he never went unarmed, and the beasts seldom attacked unless disturbed. There was a road of sorts to follow, and the cyclos must have made a habit of coming here from the mine site, perhaps to swim, for the road went across the bluff and down to a beach on the other side. No, not to swim. Cyclos didn't like swimming. Perhaps to go boating? Once he had read that this lake area had been one of the most heavily populated on the continent. Several millions had lived here. The cyclos seemed to have taken care of them long, long ago, for there was not even a trace of fields or huts, much less people, left. He wondered why the cyclos mainly hunted people. Dr. McKendrick said it was probably a matter of sympathetic nerve vibration. Animals might not suffer acutely enough to add to the enjoyment of the monsters. Or perhaps it was just that man's nerve pattern, in a body with two arms, two legs, and upright, paralleled their own. Even their nerve gas specialized in sentient beings, and was far less effective on four-legged creatures and reptiles. There was a cyclo text on its use, and it said as much. Something about its being attuned to more highly developed central nervous systems. But whatever might be the reasons for that, these cyclos at the mine site had not made much of a dent in the game. And the game, smelling him, did not go racing away. He suddenly realized that he didn't smell even vaguely like a cyclo. The storm out there was building up. He glanced toward the very distant mine site to see whether there was any rush getting back there to beat the storm. Very tiny in the distance, a small tri-wheeler ground car had left the mine. Somebody coming. To see him? Or just somebody out for a ride? Johnny went back to pitching rocks. The current state of affairs was a bit gloomy. One of the cyclos had died. The other three were holding on. They had found about a third of the corpses had two items in their heads, and Dr. McKendrick was practicing on the cadavers to find out how to bore in and remove them without killing a cyclo, in case one of the last three made it. They still had two with two objects in their heads. Might even be a relief to them to get rid of the hideous things. But Johnny did not much like all this business with cadavers, and he turned his mind to something more cheerful. During the battle, he had made an interesting discovery. He had been flying that mine platform with two hands. He hadn't recalled that until a week had gone by. McKendrick said it was another part of his brain taking over the lost functions. Under stress, he had assumed, those lost functions and nerves healed because of a battle. But Johnny didn't believe that. Johnny's theory was that he manipulated the nerves, and it was working. He had begun by simply willing his arm and leg to do what he wanted. Each day he had gotten a bit better, and now he could trot, no cane, and he could throw. For a hunter, trained as he was, the inability to sling a kill club had made him feel helpless, and here he was, pitching rocks. He threw one out. It went arcing through the air, down off the bluff, and sent a small white geyser up in the lake, the plunk coming back to him a moment later. Pretty good, if he did say it himself. The storm out there was towering up a bit higher. grayish-black, a bit ugly. He glanced toward the mine site and found the tri-wheeler had almost arrived. It stopped. For a moment, Johnny did not recognize the rider, and he stepped nearer to him, questioningly. Then he saw it was the third duplicate of him, a man they called Stormalong. His real name was Stam Stavanger, member of a Norwegian group who had emigrated to Scotland from Norway in ages past, and who had preserved their names and lineage, but not their customs. They looked and acted like Scots. He was Johnny's height and build, and had eyes like Johnny's, but his hair was a shade darker, and his skin very much more tanned. Since the load days, he had not bothered to keep up the resemblance, and had cut his beard square at the bottom. Stormalong had stayed at the academy. A skilled pilot, he enjoyed teaching the new cadets to fly. He had found an ancient flying coat, a white scarf, and a huge pair of goggles from a bygone age, and he affected these. They gave him a bit of dash.
Hey,
they swatted each other on the back and grinned at each other.
Hey, they told me I'd find you down here throwing rocks at the Crocs,
said Stormalong.
How's the arm?
You must have seen the last one I threw,
said Johnny.
It might not have knocked down one of these elephants, but it's getting there.
He guided him over to a big flat rock overlooking the lake, and they sat down. The storm was building up, but it was an easy run back. Stormalong was seldom very talkative, but right now he was full of news. It had taken some ferreting out, real badger digging, to find where Johnny was. Nobody knew in America, so he had gone to Scotland to find him or some trace of him. Chrissy sent her love. He'd already given patties to Biddy. The chief of Clan Fergus had sent his respects, mind you, not his regards, but his respects. His Aunt Ellen sent her love. She was married to the parson now and in Scotland. He'd gotten on Johnny's trail through the two coordinators who had gone back to Scotland, the ones sent out to bring in some tribe or other. The Brigades? The Brigantes. Oh, that mob was up in Denver now. Horrible people. He'd seen some. Anyway, they'd brought Allison's body home for burial, and Scotland was in an uproar over the murder of Allison. But that wasn't what he wanted to tell Johnny. The craziest thing had happened on his flight over.
You know how you said we could get invaded again here on Earth? Well, it does seem possible.
He'd been coming over to Scotland on the North Great Circle, flying an ordinary battle plane, making good time, and just as he reached the northern tip of Scotland, right there on his view screen and visual as well, he had seen the biggest, most enormous craft he ever hoped to see. For a moment, he thought he was running into it and would crash right then. There it was on his screens and through his windshield. But bang! He hit it. But it wasn't there.
Not there?
Asked Johnny. Well, that was exactly it. He'd run into a solid object that wasn't there. Right in the sky, mind you. Big as all the sky, but not there. Here, he had the screen pictures in this pack. Johnny looked at it. It was a sphere with a ring around it. Nothing like any ship he had ever heard of. And it looked huge. In fact, at the corner, the Orkney Islands were visible. It looked like it reached from mid-Scotland to the Orkneys. The next consecutive picture showed it enveloping the battle plane, taking the shot, and the third one showed it was gone.
The ship that wasn't there,
said Stormalong.
Light,
said Johnny, suddenly recalling some man theories.
This thing could have been going faster than light. It left its image behind. That's a guess, you know, but I read that they thought that things that went faster than light could look as big as the whole universe. It's in some texts on nuclear physics we had. I didn't understand most of it.
Well, that just could be. Because the old woman said it wasn't that big.
The old woman? Well, it's like this. When he had gotten over his scare, he had backtracked his screen recorders. He hadn't noticed it in approaching Scotland. You know how it is, you get groggy on a long flight, not alert, and he hadn't had much sleep lately, cadets being what they were, slow to graduate when desperately needed by the overloaded pilots. The backtrack of the screens show this little trace coming up from a farm west of Kinlochbervie. You know, on the northwest coast of Scotland. That little place? Well, he cranked down his speed and went into that spot, expecting maybe the place had been raided or shot up. But there was just a burned spot in the rocks. A farm raises mostly rocks around there. And he didn't see any other damage or hostile force, so he landed near the house. An old woman came out, all fluttery about two callers from the sky in one day when she didn't usually see anybody for months on end. And he was made to sit down and have some yarb tea, and she showed him this new, shiny pocket knife.
A pocket knife?
Said Johnny. This ordinarily very quiet Norwegian Scot was taking his time about getting down to it. Well, yes. They'd seen some in ruined cities, remember? They folded in on themselves. Only this one was shiny as could be. Yes, I am getting on with it. So anyway, according to what the old woman told him, there she was combing her dog that often got burrs in him, and it almost startled her witless. Standing right behind her was a small, gray man. And right behind him was a big gray sphere with a ring around it, parked right where the cow was usually staked out. Like to have frightened her silly daft, she said. There hadn't been a sound, maybe only a bit of wind. So she asked the small gray man in for a cup of yarb tea, just like she asked me, except that I'd had the manners to come down roaring and announcing myself. But the small gray man was very pleasant. He looked a bit smaller than most men. His skin was gray, his hair was gray, and his suit gray. The only thing odd about him was he had a box he wore on a strap around his neck and hung on his chest. He'd say something to this box, and then, presently, the box would speak English. The small gray man's voice was quiet and had different tones, and the box only had one tone, a monotone.
A vocoder, said Johnny. A portable translation device. A cyclotext describes them, but the cyclos don't use them.
Well, all right. But anyway, this small gray man asked her whether she had any newspapers. And no, because of course she'd never seen a newspaper. Few people have. And then he asked her whether she had any history books. And she was disappointed to have to tell him she had heard of a book, but didn't have any. Well, apparently he thought she didn't understand. So the small gray man made a lot of motions to indicate something printed on paper was what he wanted. So she got very helpful. Seems like somebody had bought some wool from her and given her a couple of those new credits in exchange. And explained what they were.
What credits?
Oh, you haven't seen them?
And Stormalong fished in his pockets and found one.
They pay us now. With these.
It was a one-credit note from the new Planetary Bank, and Johnny looked at it with casual interest. Then his attention riveted on the picture. A picture of him, waving a gun. He didn't think it was all that good a likeness, and also it embarrassed him a bit. So anyway, Stormalong went on, the old woman had accepted them because of the picture of you, and she had one of them on the wall. And she sold it to the small gray man for the pocket knife, because she had another one she could put on the wall.
I should think that was a cheap price for the pocket knife, if it was as fancy as you say,
said Johnny. Well, Stormalong hadn't thought about that. But anyway, the small gray man finished his yarb tea and put the banknote away, very carefully, between two pieces of metal, and put them in an inside pocket. And then he thanked her, and went back to the ship and said something to somebody inside and got in. He called back for the old woman not to come close and shut the door. And then there was a curl of flame and it rose up and then all of a sudden it got as big as the whole sky and vanished. Yes, as Johnny said, probably a phenomenon of light. But it didn't fly like our ships and it didn't teleport. It didn't seem to be cyclo. What with the man being a small, gray man. Johnny had become very quiet. Some other alien race? Interested in Earth now that the cyclos weren't here? He looked across the lake, puzzling about it. The storm was building even higher. Well, be that as it may, continued Stormalong, that wasn't why he was here. He fumbled in a flat case he carried for maps.
It's a letter from Kerr. And he said I had to bring it personally and not let it get out of my hands. I owe him favors, and he said if you didn't get it, the whole shaft would fall in. Here it is.